Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to continue with our discussion of the Right to Die movement. Now, for listeners who've just tuned in to this segment, this is the second segment in a two-part series, a two-half-hour segment series, and in the beginning of the segment, I explained some of the historical and political antecedents to this discussion. Those antecedents are, first of all, the concept of fascism as the corporate state. Mussolini, the world's first fascist who invented the name and the system, although one could argue the system predated Mussolini, defined fascism as corporatism and defined his system as the corporate state. The pro-corporate, anti-communist, and anti-labor stance of Nazism earned both Hitler and Mussolini, or of fascism, I should say, earned both Hitler and Mussolini the profound, absolutely pivotal support of most of the most powerful industrialist financiers and corporations in the United States, Britain, and elsewhere. This had much to do with the ultimate success on the battlefield and politically of both Hitler and Mussolini. And from the standpoint of intellectual and scientific background, the Nazi racial laws, which led directly to the Nazi extermination programs, were the direct outgrowth of eugenics thinking and eugenics legislation, which profoundly influenced American thinking and legislation, as well as that in Germany. In many ways, the Nazi racial laws were the outgrowth of eugenics thinking and eugenics legislation, which had its epicenter here in the United States. We should also note that one of the outgrowths of the international eugenics movement was the international euthanasia movement, which led in Germany to the Tiergartenstrasse 4, or T4 program, the German, quote, euthanasia or mercy killing program, which began with the Naur case, the euthanizing by the German authorities of a horribly deformed infant. This opened the door for legalized state killing in Germany, and eventually the Nazi euthanasia program accelerated to the full-blown Nazi extermination programs. It began with the horribly deformed Naur infant, was then extended to the terminally ill, then the gravely ill, the mentally ill, the disabled, the very old, and simply those who had serious diseases but were not deemed socially worthy of treatment. Eventually, the Nazis' political and racial enemies were included under this particular deadly umbrella. Against the background of corporatism and against the background of the deindustrialization of the United States and America's debt situation, we are now the world's biggest debtor nation. And in addition to that, Ronald Reagan and George Bush tripled the national debt and more than tripled it. Reagan tripled the national debt in his 8 years. Bush pushed it up over $4 trillion. It was only $900 billion when Jimmy Carter left office. Sooner or later, these economic chickens are going to come home to roost, and when they do, I suspect that the pressure to escalate our mercy-killing program will escalate according to the social and economic pressures, and I expect those to be grave. In our last segment, we discussed some of the test cases now before U.S. courts. We also discussed Dr. Timothy Quill, a physician who has become one of the leading advocates for the Right to Die movement. And I want to stress again that I am not impugning Dr. Quill's motives, but even in his rhetoric, we can see the gradual gravitation and escalation of physician-assisted suicide to euthanasia. And it is against the background of that escalation or gravitation and against the background of the T4 or Tiergartenstrasse 4 program that I think we need to examine this entire issue. We have been dealing with some columns from the Village Voice written by Nat Hentoff, who's been doing some excellent work on the Right to Die movement, one of the only people focusing on this particular issue. And against the background of what Hentoff has termed the slippery slope and the escalating rhetoric of even respectable advocates such as Dr. Timothy Quill, we are now going to examine the euthanasia program in the Netherlands. And bear in mind that the Netherlands is a much more humanitarian and generally much more enlightened society than the United States. And by way of examining not only the historical precedent for euthanasia in Nazi Germany, but also the modern historical precedent of euthanasia in the Netherlands, we are going to examine this next Nat Hentoff column. Research credit on the following also goes to a listener. This is from the Village Voice of February 18th of 1997. Again, this column is by Nat Hentoff. It's entitled Death in the Netherlands. Dutch doctors kill, quote, defective, unquote, children with impunity. There is much interest in the Netherlands in the assisted suicide and euthanasia cases now before our Supreme Court. For more than 10 years, Dutch doctors have been empowered to help patients kill themselves And increasingly, physicians there have been directly killing patients, sometimes without being asked to. A Dutch television crew came to The Voice to interview me because I have reported extensively on Dutch death on demand for this paper and The Washington Post. I told the interviewer of the great respect I had for Dutch physicians during the Nazi occupation of that land. The Germans disbanded the Dutch Medical Association and ordered the doctors to join the new one headed by a Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite. 98% of the Dutch physicians refused and were told that they were no longer doctors. The Dutch physicians took down their shingles and did not practice, even though they knew severe sanctions might well have been taken against them, and they continued to resist. What surprises and angers me, I told Dutch TV, is that despite that courageous model of Dutch doctors during the Nazi occupation, doctors in the Netherlands today are engaged in terminating patients. Moreover, when many ignore the guidelines that were set when physicians were given the power to kill, the patient must repeatedly, voluntarily ask for death. The patient's suffering must be unbearable and without the prospect of improvement. At least one other doctor must be consulted. For Dutch viewers, I quoted Dr. Herbert Hendin, H-E-N-D-I-N, whose most recent book is Seduced by Death, Doctors, Patients, and the Dutch Cure, put out by the Norton Press. Continuing. Testifying before a congressional subcommittee, Hendin illuminated the irreversible Dutch slippery slope that American supporters of assisted suicide would wish upon us. Quote, the Netherlands has moved from assisted suicide to euthanasia, from euthanasia for people who are terminally ill to euthanasia for those who are chronically ill, from euthanasia for a physical illness to euthanasia for psychological distress, and from voluntary euthanasia to involuntary euthanasia, called in the Netherlands, quote, termination of the patient without explicit request, unquote. Again, notice this escalation. It is this escalation which alarms Nat Hentoff and also yours truly, and this should be seen against the background of not only the American eugenics influence on the Nazi racial laws and their euthanasia program, but also the American corporate connections to Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. Again, quoting Dr. Hendin, quote, the Netherlands has moved from assisted suicide to euthanasia, from euthanasia for people who are terminally ill to euthanasia for those who are chronically ill, from euthanasia for physical illness to euthanasia for psychological distress, and from voluntary euthanasia to involuntary euthanasia, called in the Netherlands, quote, termination of the patient without explicit request, unquote. I then asked the Dutch TV interviewer how the Dutch people can justify not only this, quote, quality of life, unquote, killing of adults, which brings back memories of the Nazi occupiers, but also the liquidating of, quote, defective, unquote, children. An account of the euthanizing of children in the Netherlands comes from Dr. Richard Fenigsen, F-E-N-I-G-S-E-N, a cardiologist in the Netherlands. I got to know him about 8 years ago, and he predicted that Dutch euthanasia would go inexorably out of control because there are no truly binding limits once society gives doctors the power to kill. In a September 1996 report by our House Subcommittee on the Constitution, Dr. Fenigsen tells of a Dutch 3-year-old who had spina bifida but was otherwise in, quote, fair general condition, unquote. For 2 days, he did not feel quite well, and his parents asked for euthanasia. How could a 3-year-old have protested? One nurse, appalled, opposed the decision, and she and her husband offered to adopt the child. The offer was turned down. The boy was killed by physicians, quote, with drugs administered with intravenous drip, unquote. And dig this, quote, the nurse was reprimanded because by involving her husband in the adoption offer, she violated professional confidentiality, unquote. I used to think that the Netherlands was an exceptionally civilized nation. In January, during oral arguments in our Supreme Court on the assisted suicide and euthanasia cases, Justice David Souter said, quote, maybe the court should wait to make a decision until it can know more about the actual risks, unquote. We know a lot now. The Netherlands is the only country in the world to have instituted wide-ranging legal killing by physicians, and the last 10 years has provided a full, detailed record of what that decision has led to. I would suggest that Justice Souter and the other members of the Supreme Court examine that Dutch record before bringing death on demand to the United States and creating a culture of death. From the Congressional Subcommittee report on, quote, physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia in the Netherlands, unquote, and the report is quoted here, Dr. Fenningsen worries about the long-term effect of the permissive attitude in the Netherlands toward euthanasia for people with disabilities. There seems to be little tolerance for disabled children and the parents who raise them. In fact, Professor J. Stolk, S-T-O-L-K, a specialist in mental retardation at the Free University in Amsterdam, has documented cases where parents of disabled children are rebuked. For example, parents have heard statements such as, "What? Is that child still alive? How can one love such a child?" unquote. Nowadays, such a being need not be born at all, unquote. Such a thing should have been given an injection, unquote. 8 years ago, Dr. Fenningsen told me of elderly people in the Netherlands who were afraid to go to the hospital. They didn't want to die, and they feared that a doctor, feeling compassionate about these old folks' frailness, would decide to euthanize them. And they knew of others to whom that had actually happened. A 1995 study of euthanasia in the Netherlands disclosed that 23% of the doctors interviewed reported that they had euthanized the patient without his or her explicit request. One more time, a 1995 study of euthanasia in the Netherlands disclosed that 23% of the doctors interviewed reported that they had euthanized the patient without his or her explicit request. I would interject, folks, that is called murder. Furthermore, at least half of Dutch physicians involved made the initial suggestion that death should be embraced. That is, they suggested euthanasia to patients. But what about the guidelines that said that that request had to come voluntarily from the patient? Says Dr. Herbert Hendon, virtually every guideline established by the Dutch to regulate euthanasia has been modified or violated with impunity, unquote. I wonder what the Dutch doctors who resisted Nazi orders would think of their successors. And if euthanasia becomes legal in this country, will future generations of American physicians feel no qualms about disposing of the, quote, unworthy, unquote? Indeed, I think Nat Hentoff is asking the right questions here. The next Nat Hentoff column that I'm going to read, also from the Village Voice, is from February 25th of 1997. This column is entitled by Nat Hentoff, "Would Your Doctor Kill?" Subtitled, "Said the Disabled Man, We Want Real Health Care, Not the Right to Die." Lucy Gwynn is the editor of Mouth, a magazine in which people with disabilities speak from deep within their own experiences, fears, and rage. Outside the Supreme Court on January 8th, a group called Not Dead Yet, which Gwynn helped organize, demonstrated against assisted suicide and euthanasia, issues the High Court was considering that day. Lucy Gwynn told Mary Meehan, M-E-E-H-A-N, an invaluable reporter for the National Catholic Register who was covering the protest, quote, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to die for Jack Kevorkian or Tim Quill. You're not going to herd us off one at a time quietly into little rooms. We're going to be loud about this because we want to live," unquote. Also outside the Supreme Court that morning was Diane Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, a founder of Not Dead Yet, with a very strong record in disability rights. Her sense of the reign of death that may be coming was reported by Diane Ginelli, G-I-A-N-N-E-L-L-I, of American Medical News. Ginelli is another reporter on life and death issues with much deeper understanding and precision than anyone in the mainstream press. Behind Coleman was a demonstrator waving a sign, "We want real health care, not the right to die." Coleman said that legalizing assisted suicide would create, quote, a double standard based on health status, unquote. For example, she pointed out, when a mother on the West Coast killed her disabled daughter, the judge ruled that the murder was, quote, understandable, unquote, and sentenced the woman only to community service. In the Washington Post, Evan Kemp, K-E-M-P, who is disabled and is a former chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, told of, quote, Marjorie Nibert, N-I-G-H-B-E-R-T, a 76-year-old Florida woman who was hospitalized in 1996 after a stroke. Before her hospital admission, she signed an advance directive that no, quote, heroic measures, unquote, should be employed to save her life. Quote, on the basis of that directive, and at the request of her family, the hospital denied Nibert's request for food and water, according to reports in the Northwest Florida Daily News. A hurriedly convened hospital ethics committee ruled that she was not, quote, medically competent to ask for such a treatment, unquote. That is, to ask for food. Until her death more than 10 days later, Nibert was restrained in her bed to prevent her from raiding other patients' food trays, unquote. A double standard based on health status as to who shall eat, or, as Nazi doctors used to say, quote, useless eaters, unquote, are not entitled to food. Please note, before I continue with this Nat Hentoff column, please note that this woman was hospitalized with a stroke, and that she was asking for food and water, and that was denied to her. Those were deemed to be heroic measures to save her life. Basically, she was obliged. She was executed through starvation and thirst. And again, when I express my anxieties about the gravitational or escalational nature, or escalating nature, of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia, and when I reflect on the possibilities that in the event of an economic collapse and resulting political catastrophe, euthanasia in this country could lead to what it led to in Germany, with profound antecedents in this country for fascism and Nazism, as I've already explained. Take a look at the example of Marjorie Nibert. This happened in this country in 1996. Continuing with the Nat Hentoff column from February 20, The Village Voice of February 25th, 1997. In their righteous zeal to promote, quote, death with dignity, unquote, and, quote, choice in dying, unquote, the promoters of assisted suicide, including, alas, the American Civil Liberties Union, have forgotten the powerful role of the doctor in deciding who lives and who dies, particularly after he or she is given the power to kill. Dr. Catherine Foley, F-O-L-E-Y, co-chief of the Pain and Palliative Care Service at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, emphasizes that patients depend upon physicians, quote, for their perspective on how the illness may go, and physicians make decisions about a patient's quality of life that may well encourage patients to seek assistance in death, unquote. For example, Foley said on National Public Radio, quote, physicians consistently underestimate the quality of living for those individuals who are disabled, unquote. Some years ago, I was researching the attitudes of physicians toward children who have been born with spina bifida, in which the spinal cord protrudes through the spinal column. Doctors who had a rather grim view of life did not offer much hope that the child would function well as an adult. On the other hand, doctors who were rather cheerful by nature gave the patients reason to believe that, with proper care, the child would do well. If parents had gone to the first kind of doctor, the future quality of life of their child would have been negatively affected. So, too, with dying patients. The grim doctors could well suggest physician-assisted suicide. The cheerful physician would involve the patient in palliative care, including pain control, so that death would be both comfortable and natural. See Dr. Ira B. Yock's, Y-O-C-K's, new book, Dying Well, The Prospect for Growth at the End of Life. That's put out by Riverhead Books, G.P. Putnam's. Continuing with the column. The most telling example I know of how a physician's attitude affected a patient came from a Dutch cardiologist, Dr. Richard Fenigsen, F-E-N-I-G-S-E-N. I thought of him when a not-dead-yet protester at the Supreme Court held up a sign, "If I get sick, I'll be damned if I want to be in the Netherlands," unquote. This is the story told by Dr. Fenigsen in Issues and Law and Medicine. Mrs. P, quote, Mrs. P was a 72-year-old widow who, after a bad myocardial infarction, was left with a grossly enlarged heart and congestive heart failure. She was treated with digoxin, D-I-G-O-X-I-N, a diuretic, and an anticoagulant. For a whole year, she had almost no symptoms at rest. True, she needed help with cleaning the house, and her only exercise was walking a few blocks. One night, her breathlessness recurred. This required adding a third pillow and an increased dosage of the diuretic. Another time, she complained of dizziness, which turned out to be due to a fall in blood pressure in an upright position. She was taught the necessary precautions. Mrs. P. was an extremely nice, mild-tempered lady who never showed any impatience and complied with the doctor's every order and advice. Barring some clot or a sudden disturbance in heart rhythm, both of which could, of course, occur, she might have remained for years in the condition she was in. When she once failed to appear at the outpatient clinic, I was very much worried. Responding to my inquiry, her family physician, Dr. Decay, paid me a visit. He had had a talk with Mrs. P., he said, and explained the situation to her. This wasn't going to be any better, and living such a limited life with all these pills made no sense at all. Mrs. P. accepted everything he said. He stopped her pills, and 3 days later, she died. My only answer was to nod. I couldn't emit a sound. I was overcome by deep sorrow, and it returns every time I think of Mrs. P., unquote. The Supreme Court's decision on whether to legalize assisted suicide and euthanasia will not come down until late June or early July. If the court speaks for death, check out your doctor. Would he or she kill you? And indeed, I think Nat Hentoff has set forth the issues about the escalation or gravitation of physician-assisted suicide into euthanasia and terminating those who have a bad existential quality of life in the estimation of the physician. And again, the attitude of the physician is very, very important here. I would note that recently a federal court threw out a challenge to the state of Oregon's Right to Die Act. The following is from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, February 28th of 1997. This is a Reuters story, Dateline San Francisco, and headlined, Oregon Right to Die Act Survives Appeal, and it reads in part as follows. A federal appeals court Thursday threw out a lawsuit challenging Oregon's so-called Death with Dignity Act, unquote, which allows doctor-assisted suicide for the terminally ill. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the lawsuit brought by a group of patients, doctors, and nursing homes should be dismissed because they lacked standing. The appeals court ruled that doctors and terminally ill patients must allege, quote, concrete and imminent injury, unquote, to challenge the constitutionality of a state's, quote, right to die, unquote, statute. But opponents of Oregon's Measure 16, the Death with Dignity Act, said the appeals court decision was flawed. They vowed to keep the law on hold while appealing the ruling to the full Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court if necessary. Quote, there are very strong constitutional arguments against Measure 16, unquote, plaintiff's attorney Richard Colson said, that's C-O-L-E-S-O-N. Again quoting, those arguments were not considered by the Ninth Circuit. So please note that as of late February of 1997, the drift in the courts toward physician-assisted suicide, which may very well drift towards euthanasia and perhaps worse in the event of an economic collapse and a resulting political catastrophe, that drift is continuing. I've spoken already briefly this evening, or in this broadcast, about the profound corporate connections of American the profound connections between American corporations and financiers and American industrialists and financiers to their counterparts in Germany. Indeed, 70% of the investment capital that went to build up Hitler's war-making industry, as well as the corporations that elevated Hitler to a position of power, came from the United States and Britain, mostly the United States. And I've dealt with that in numerous archive shows. The first two RFA shows, RFA number 10, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, U.S. Industrial Support for Nazi Germany, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, and the miscellaneous archive show entitled Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans. Also some half-hour segments entitled Il Martello, The Roots of the Cold War, and the tribute to George Seldes deal with the American corporate connections to fascism. I would also recommend a two-hour interview in four half-hour segments with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, the co-author of the landmark book, The Secret War Against the Jews, which documents many of these connections. One of the German industrial institutions which had some of the most profound connections to American industry and finance, and which in turn was centrally involved with the Third Reich's war-making capacity, as well as with the political elevation of Hitler, was the IG Farben Company, Interessengemeinschaft Farben Industry, the German dyestuffs and chemical industry. That gigantic company was broken up into four companies at the end of World War II, although basically the IG has continued to function. I'm going to repeat an article as the last item in this broadcast that I read in an earlier segment entitled Fascism, Eugenics, and Euthanasia. Actually, those 2 half-hour segments are available from Spitfire. Research credit on the following goes to a listener who researched this article, I should say, from the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, December 31st of 1996. One of the companies that IG Farben was broken up into was the Hoechst Company, that's H-O-E-C-H-S-T, Hoechst AG, was one of the member companies of IG Farben. And I would note in this context that Hoechst has basically financed the development of a euthanasia drug at Michigan State University. This drug was licensed initially for euthanizing animals and for use in Europe, but it has been reserved in terms of its patents for euthanizing human beings as well. And I would note that IG Farben was the company, an IG subsidiary, was the company that made the Zyklon B, the gas that was used to exterminate the Jews in the concentration camp. So there's an ironic, potentially ironic historical coincidence here of Hoechst AG's development of a euthanasia drug at Michigan State University. The San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, December 31st of 1996, has the following to say. This from the Science and Technology pages. This article is entitled, Euthanasia Drug Patent Includes Use on Humans. The first patent for a euthanasia drug combination with potential human use, developed by Michigan State University with research money from a giant German chemical company, has been granted in Europe. In April, the European Patent Office granted an application filed by the university for a, quote, euthanasia composition, unquote, originally intended for animals, which was developed by its scientists with more than $350,000 in research grants from American subsidiaries of the German company Hoechst AG. Though the patent applies to killing, quote, mammals, unquote, such as dogs and horses, it would also allow the drug compound to be used for human beings in any European Economic Community nation that legalizes doctor-assisted suicide or euthanasia, patent documents show. University officials acknowledged that they worded the European patent on their euthanasia compound to include humans to cover the possibility of legalization. But, they now say, they have no intention of allowing anyone to use the drugs for that purpose. I would add that that may change in time if some of the pressures that I am afraid will come to bear do indeed come to bear with the results that I am afraid of. Again, beware the slippery slope. All of the half-hour segments that I've produced, as well as the various interviews and archive shows I've alluded to, are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be contacted at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California. That's capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. There's also an email address, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, one word, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.